Item one, economic statistics, what they tell you and what they do not. Item two, the Federal Reserve is, I believe, making a point. Item three, oh, you know, everything else. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 16th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today with an object lesson in, if it sounds too good to be true, yeah, probably kinda, it is. The Commerce Department enlightened us this morning about the state of retail sales in this economy, specifically the report for May. Eye-popping is a word you could use, up almost 18% from April, a record percentage gain-wise. But come on, you really want to judge this economy right now on a month-to-month comparison? I didn't think so. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
When New York started reopening, it was time for William Bell to go outside.
I just want to go and run an errand. I want to get out of the house.
So off he went to the majestic, soothing aisles of Home Depot.
I needed help picking out a flower pot. I got the advice of one of the people who worked there, and she literally came up right next to me and was helping me pick out the right one. It was a little weird being that close to each other, but we both had masks on, so we kind of just accepted it.
Lots and lots of William Bells went shopping last month. Clothing and accessory store sales were up 188% month over month. Furniture and home furnishings up 90%. Electronics and appliances up 51%. If you take out car dealers, gas, and restaurants, retail sales were actually up 1.7% in May year over year, according to the National Retail Federation, where Jack Kleinens is chief economist.
It was categorically good news for the economy. It was categorically good news for the consumer.
And now let's all go shopping for a brand new reality check. Lindsay Piegza has one for free. She's chief economist at Stifel.
Yes, we did have some pent-up demand, but going forward with unemployment benefits ending, with the PPP program coming to an end, will the consumer be able to continue to spend at these more positive levels?
No, according to Joe Bruswellis at RSM.
My sense is that the pub doesn't quite understand, nor do policy, many policymakers for that matter, the fiscal cliff that awaits the U.S. economy in just 6 weeks.
6 weeks is about when those additional unemployment payments end. Dazzling increases aside, retail sales are still down 8% off their January peak. And yeah, lots of businesses will come back, but some won't. David Swartz is an equity analyst at Morningstar Research.
Some people will be permanently unemployed who right now may not understand that.
The Federal Reserve estimates that at the end of the year, another 6 months from now, the unemployment rate will still be at 9%. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Okay, so speaking of the Fed, we are going to do a brief disquisition now of the Federal Reserve. First, what it is saying and then what it is doing. It has not escaped our notice around these parts that in the past couple of days, a couple of three presidents of regional Federal Reserve banks have been out and about commenting on some economic issues of the day. First, there was Rob Kaplan of the Dallas Fed on Face the Nation this past Sunday.
Fiscal policy from here is going to be a critical element of the recovery.
Fiscal policy, Congress and the White House, taxing, and more to the point, spending. Then Mary Daly of the San Francisco Fed at a National Press Club event with Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
Monetary policy alone can't put us back to where we need to be. We also need fiscal policymakers to commit to sustained investments in our economic future. The need for this was evident before the crisis, and it's even more evident now.
Then on this program yesterday, Rafael Bostic of the Atlanta Fed, when I asked him whether he'd agree with what his colleague said.
I'm committed to going and talking to policymakers, making sure they're aware of places where there does seem to be distress that's continuing as a result of the pandemic. And I'm going to encourage them to think hard about doing things to help those people.
So that's a yes. The point being, the Fed seems focused, incredibly focused, on getting Congress to do something and doing it sooner rather than later. One more thing about all three of those people. They each said some variation of this. This is Rafael Bostic here yesterday.
For many people, the systemic racism is so ingrained in everything that we do on a basic level that they don't even see it. They don't think about it as a structured inhibitor of African Americans' ability to do the things that other people get to do with no questions. And I think what's changed is that people are seeing things happen that are getting them to think, well, maybe things are different for African Americans. Maybe we should talk about this more and get a deeper understanding.
Let me just, in a rare moment of shameless self-promotion here, recommend to you that interview I did yesterday with Dr. Bostic. It was all him, the good stuff, not me. It's on our website. Also, and more to the point, his essay on systemic racism in this economy. We'll have a link to that too, obviously, marketplace.org. All right, so as promised, what the Fed is doing, and it is doing a lot. Among the latest, the central bank started buying corporate bonds today. That is not new. It was announced a couple of months ago, but it's a big deal as the Fed does what it can to backstop companies and their employees. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains how it's going to work.
When a company wants to borrow money, it can issue corporate bonds. The buyers of those bonds are lending those companies money. Now the Fed is going to buy a broad cross-section of corporate bonds if they meet certain standards. They must have been rated as investment grade, that is, less risky, as of March, before the coronavirus lockdown started. Christopher Whalen is chair of Whalen Global Advisors.
You know, the Fed is trying to be helpful because they are really uncertain about what's going to happen later this year.
Whalen says the Fed wants to be sure companies have all the money they need to weather the pandemic. The Fed is also making this program anonymous, just buying up corporate bonds without anybody asking it to. That avoids any stigma from companies requesting Fed help. Catherine Judge is a Columbia University law professor.
There's always a concern that if you're looking to the Federal Reserve as opposed to the market for financing, that you might be revealing something about how desperate you are for financing.
The thinking is if companies have all the financing they need at reasonable rates, with the Fed buying their bonds, they won't need to lay off more workers. Frank Notaff is chief economist at CoreLogic.
The purpose is to help these companies remain good employers in the marketplace, stand on their feet, not lay people off, and hopefully bring people back into the workforce.
And if a company isn't able to stay on its feet and defaults on the bonds the Fed bought, Chairman Jay Powell can turn to an emergency fund set up by the Treasury Department to backstop the Fed. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, stop me, would you, if you've heard this one before. The Trump administration is floating a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Yes, it is infrastructure week again. That was all traders needed to hear. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Big unknown in this economy, well, one of them anyway, because there are a lot of big unknowns, to be honest, is, as Joe Brusuela said in Sabree's piece, what is going to happen when expanded unemployment benefits run out at the end of next month, even with tens of millions more people than usual still being out of a job. Unemployment is a big policy worry over in China as well. The official statistics there say the jobless rate is around 6%. The real figure, almost certainly a good deal higher. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack set out to discover how China's unemployed are getting along, and it turns out they're doing better than you might think.
Zhang Lei is an assistant manager at this entertainment center in Shanghai, some 300 miles away from his home village in eastern Anhui province. During the pandemic, his salary was cut. Then later, he was placed on furlough. Faced with these setbacks, he did something you might not expect. He started planning a vacation.
I have not traveled much since I started working. And since there were no part-time jobs opening during the pandemic, I started looking up places that were not badly affected by the coronavirus.
At a time when most of us are vacationing on our couches, Zhang Lei packed a hat, some swimming shorts, and he flew to southern Hainan Island.
I mostly spent my time at the beach, surfing, swimming, and shopping.
That one-week vacation cost him $1,000, about a month's salary for him, but less than the average monthly wage in Shanghai. So, how does someone who hasn't been paid a regular wage for 4 months afford a last-minute beach vacation? Well, savings.
I'd usually put away 3,000 to 4,000 yuan a month.
About half his take-home pay. The latest available data on savings in China comes from 2016. It shows the average household put away 36% of disposable income. In the U.S., it's just 7%. Yu Ting is an esthetician in China's Hubei province. She saves regularly for her daughter's education, her own retirement, and medical care for her elderly parents. China may be communist, but under its healthcare system, people still have to pay, and a big illness can bankrupt a family.
In the U.S., you could have a comfortable life with a job and a house and a car, but even if you have all that in China, we still feel insecure.
Yu Ting says she usually saves at least 40% of her salary, which has come in handy during the pandemic. She was furloughed for 3 months. Then when she returned to work, her boss cut wages by so much, she resigned. But she felt it was a layoff in disguise. Like most people who moved to the cities for work, Yu Ting has returned home to the countryside to plan her next step.
My mindset has changed a bit with the pandemic. I will definitely save more in the future.
Luckily, the apartment she's living in was paid off just before the pandemic hit, with a little help from her parents-in-law. The bank of mom and dad is usually the first place people in China seek help, even though most are big savers themselves. A recent Marketplace Edison poll showed that 2 out of 5 Americans surveyed didn't have $250 to spare, say for an unexpected medical bill, at the end of the month, a statistic that shocked Yu Ting.
I don't believe it. I think most Chinese families can easily take out $250 without a problem.
Back in Shanghai, Zhang Lei is back at work managing the entertainment center. He even got a bit of a raise. On the phone with his mom, he tells her he just got paid and will be sending her money that she will save on his behalf, as usual. Zhang Lei says his mom brags to her friends about how much he saves, a habit, she says, that will fend off poverty and perhaps even attract a bride. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Small businesses have been hit hard by this quarantine. Black-owned small businesses especially hard. Some of them, though, are getting a boost now thanks to some 21st century word of mouth. That's the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Rita Magaldi. I live in Draper, Utah, and I own Sheer Ambrosia Bakery. I specialize in baklava. I'll make the best baklava you've ever tasted in your life. So I'm working, I guess it was last Tuesday, and all of a sudden my Instagram, my Sheer Ambrosia, so my company Instagram just blew up. And I thought, what the heck is going on? So I took a few minutes and found that there were tons of people that were essentially organizing and sending out lists of Black-owned businesses in Utah. My first thought was, you know, is this charity? Like, do I want people to buy from me for the sole reason that I'm Black? You know, no, I want people to buy my product because it's good. I was all over the Salt Lake Valley delivering baklava and meeting the most amazing people. All of them were white. All of them wanted to support my business. I didn't feel like it was charity. They want to support Black members of the community. And what better way to do that than to support their businesses? Because we want to have thriving businesses where we put in a good day's work and make a product, in my case, that people enjoy. Now, I'm thinking like, wow, if this business continues, one day soon, I'll be able to be a homeowner again. And home ownership is huge when it comes to wealth. One of the major ways to close that gap between Blacks and whites is through home ownership. And this last year, when I had to sell my house, it was one of the most depressing times in my life because I thought, you know, did I do the right thing? Trying to build this business to the point where I had to sell my home. I feel like a miracle has happened because I tell you what, 3 months ago, I would have never in a million years guessed that my business would be doing, it's just booming right now.
That was Rita Magaldi. She's in Draper, Utah. Also makes the best baklava ever, or so we're told. This series only works with your help, you know, and especially even if you're not a great cook. You can hook us up, marketplace.org. Coming up.
We're largely able to keep it out.
It being that global pandemic. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 526 today, 2%, 26,289. The NASDAQ gained 169 points, 1.7%, 98 and 95. The S&P 500 advanced 58 points, about 1.9%, 31 and 24. With that big retail sales number that maybe wasn't so big that Sabri was telling you about, retail stocks were among the big gainers. Gap grew 8.4% today. Kohl's advanced 8.9%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Board of Regents at Texas A&M University has voted to create a $100 million scholarship fund to address diversity on that system's 11 campuses. Specifically, the school said, to make the university better reflect the population of Texas, which is 12% Black. Black students, though, are less than 4% of the population at the Texas A&M system's flagship campus. From Austin, Texas, Marketplace's Andy Euler spent his day figuring out how that was all going to work.
Texas A&M student Felix Reed grew up in an upper-class suburb of Houston. He's now a senior studying finance at A&M's main campus in College Station. He's white and describes his college campus as a social bubble.
We've grown up with kind of the same type of people, at least that's been my experience, and we become accustomed to those same type of people once we get to A&M.
He would like to see more people who don't look like him on campus. It'll prepare him for the workforce. He says right now, too many A&M students have a hard time understanding the civil unrest after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Elaine Mendoza heads the Board of Regents at Texas A&M. She says, with the country so focused on social inequities, there's a sense of urgency to diversify the student body.
There's no better time to get it off the ground and to make the tough investment than right now.
The university is planning to dole out the $100 million in diversity scholarships over 10 years. Julie Peller, executive director of the Higher Learning Advocates, says more schools will be rolling out new diversity initiatives like Texas A&M. She says the money is a good start.
The key, though, is watching that implementation. The key is to watch how it plays out, how those students are not only being reached, but how they're being served throughout their time on campus.
In other words, scholarships can change your demographics. But once you improve the numbers, then it's about inclusion. Peller says schools have to make their campuses feel more welcoming to more people. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Back in 2013, we went out to Sioux Falls, South Dakota for a series about parts of this economy that were working better at the local level than maybe might have been apparent by looking at the national headlines. And one of the companies we visited back then was a small business called Grand Prairie Foods. It makes eggs and stuff for hotel breakfast buffets and packaged breakfast sandwiches for grocery and convenience stores. It is also literally down the road, like a mile and a half, from that Smithfield pork processing plant that's been one of the hot spots of the pandemic that you might have heard about. Anyway, Kurt Ladenbeck is the CEO of Grand Prairie Foods. Mr. Ladenbeck, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai. Good to talk to you as well.
Tell me, would you, what this thing looked like on the way in for Grand Prairie Foods?
Well, it's been quite an adventure out here in the heartland. And actually, when things started to unravel back in March across the country, I was on vacation with my wife in South Africa, and we literally landed the week that things were really starting to heat up. And I got back home just in time to have about 80% of our purchase orders canceled because, you know, as you know, we're pretty heavily involved in the hospitality and travel industry with our food service operations. And those folks were shutting down very quickly about that time and decided they didn't need food anymore.
Yeah, I remember when we were out there a number of years ago. I remember the whole big scrambled egg thing. It was quite the set of machinery. What did you do? How did you react as you worked to save your business?
Well, we're still working to save our business because you know you don't replace 80% of your business overnight. And fortunately, since you've been here, we established a second operation that we moved that food service business to, and the plant that that you had visited when you were out here has turned into a packaged goods facility. So you know, as happened with a lot of people, as food service operations wound down, we were able to ramp up packaged goods business. So that facility is running 6 days a week, two shifts a day, and you know, we're really pumping out a lot of stuff to rebuild our business with packaged goods.
Did you do the whole PPP loan to get some operating cash and sort of tide you over?
We did. We're very fortunate to have qualified for that, and that, quite frankly, was a lifesaver. This would be a difficult road without that. So we're really grateful that that opportunity was there.
I do want to ask you, Mr. Loudenbeck, about the epidemiology of this thing, because you are in Sioux Falls, as is that big Smithfield pork plant.
That's right.
Yeah. How worried are you? How worried were you when this was starting about your employees? I mean, I imagine probably you have family members of your workers who work at that pork plant, right?
That was a rough couple of weeks, I tell you what, because, you know, it was shortly, maybe a week or two after, you know, we started shutting things down that happened. And so, you know, we were all just still kind of learning how to deal with this virus and how to keep it out of our facilities and keep people safe. And you're right, we do share a lot of family members with workers over there. But we had kind of heard rumors early that they were having some issues over there. And so we were fortuitous enough that we actually asked any employee who was associated with, lived with, close family member, whatever, of an employee at Smithfield to stay home. And we had them do that for 2 weeks. And so we were fortunate that we did have some of those folks that got positive results, but they weren't in our facility at the time that happened. So we're largely able to keep it out.
So in, say, a year, what's business going to be like at Grand Prairie Foods?
Yeah, so, you know, as I stated early, we lost about 80% of our business day one. We've recovered probably close to half of that with other packaged goods. And, you know, we feel optimistic that within the next 6 to 12 months, we'll be doing okay. You know, we're not going to be doing as well as we were before with full operations going, but we feel pretty good about where we're going with our business.
Well, best of luck to you. Kurt Loudenbeck, he is the owner and CEO, actually, of Grand Prairie Foods out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Mr. Loudenbeck, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, Kai. Appreciate the time.
This final note on the way out today, about which it'll be interesting to see what the number is for this year. Giving USA is out with its annual report on charitable giving in this country, just shy of $450 billion for 2019. That's a record in non-inflation adjusted dollars. It's up a bit more than 4% from a year earlier. That, of course, was with a growing economy and a stock market that was, shall we say, overperforming, circumstances that don't necessarily attach right now. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context for this, Tuesday, right? Yes, sorry, I forgot. It's a bookend of sorts to Sabree's piece on retail, specifically that reminder that extended unemployment benefits run out at the end of next month. From a survey by YouGov, this data, the thing most people spent their extra money on, no fun retail and pent-up consumer demand, bills and rent and utilities. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.